Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Spark, The Life of Electricity and the Electricity of Life by Timothy J. Jorgensen. Narrated by Gary Tiedemann. Publisher's note. In this audio edition, you may hear references to visual elements present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Preface. Current events. Electricity is often called wonderful, beautiful, but it is so only in common with the other forces of nature. Michael Faraday. We live in an electrical society. Most of our daily activities are powered, illuminated, and otherwise enhanced by electricity. If you've ever experienced a prolonged electrical power outage, you know what I mean. Yet, some people have curious ideas about what electricity actually is. They think of electricity as an alien physical force outside of their bodies that's confined within their electronic devices and channeled from appliance to appliance through wires. They don't appreciate that electricity is also a biological force, essential to the life of all animals that have a nervous system, and even those that don't. Many people also are unaware that electricity is really the very foundation of life. It's the spark that brought the first primitive life forms into existence and started them down the evolutionary path leading to today's complex species with sophisticated internal electrical systems. Life is nothing if not electrical. You might as well call it e-life. This is a book about electricity from a biological perspective. That may seem an unusual approach, but I think it's the best way to tell the story of electricity. That's because many attributes of electricity were first discovered through the study of electricity's effects on bodily senses and muscle tissues. And amazingly, almost everything we know about our nervous system comes from electrically probing nerves. So, it might not be too surprising that electrical science and neurological science share a joint story. Discoveries in the electrical and neurological fields leapfrogged each other over the centuries, as developments in one field enabled advancements in the other. The term electricity was first used in the late 16th century by the English scientist William Gilbert to describe his investigations of electricity's physical powers. And the term neurology was first used shortly thereafter by the English physician Thomas Willis to describe his studies of human reflexes and paralysis. Such neurological studies progressed from mere descriptions of neural anatomy to functional investigations of how the nervous system works, using targeted electrical stimulation as a probe. But it's not just nerves that respond to electrical signals. Muscle cells, including heart muscle, rely on electrical stimuli to control their mechanical functions. And even non-muscle tissues send and receive electrical signals through the nervous system, as they report their status to and receive their instructions from the brain. In fact, virtually all of our bodily functions are electrically monitored and controlled. It's because electrical regulation of cells, tissues, and organs is so vital to survival that disruption of the body's electronics can be so damaging and even lethal. With electricity all around us, we need to better know when, why, and how electricity kills. Fortunately, we have learned much about the lethal effects of electricity, especially when it's delivered in large, abrupt doses, sometimes called jolts. This information is important for the preservation and treatment of severe electrical shocks. Since its discovery, electricity has repeatedly been employed to treat various diseases. Hampered by poor understanding of human physiology, ignorance of the mechanisms of diseases, and misunderstanding of the role of electricity in the body, the track record of early electrical therapies was spotty, to say the least. Hair removal by electricity, hair electrolysis, is perhaps one of the few early electrical medical procedures that persists, little changed, to the present day. After its early heyday, in the late 19th century, electrical therapy fell out of fashion and even became taboo within the medical community. But as the electrical and neurological sciences have matured, there has been a resurgence of interest in using electricity to treat diseases. This is particularly true for treatments of neurological disorders, such as electroconvulsive therapy for depression and deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease, but is also true for many other illnesses. The use of electricity for medical purposes ranges from the mental control of prosthetic limbs by amputees to the restoration of vision to the blind. In the future, electricity may even replace many drugs as first-line therapies for treating a variety of diseases. As such, it might be possible to avoid the adverse side effects of those drugs, which can often be severe. But we are also learning that electricity's use to treat anxiety can, unfortunately, sometimes be nearly as addictive as drugs. This book is not a science textbook on electricity or electrophysiology. If you are an electrical engineer or an electrophysiologist, this book will not satisfy your specialized technological needs. Rather, it is my hope that the book will be accessible to the widest possible audience. I have, therefore, avoided technical jargon and specifically focused on the stories about electricity that are important to understanding electricity's relationship to biology and health. This is also not a history of science book. Although some of the stories I relate are taken from history, and everything in the book is historically accurate, I have made no attempt to compile a complete history of electricity. Neither this book nor any other single-volume work can do justice to electricity's long and rich history. Rather, I have selectively chosen stories that illustrate the scientific points I want to focus on regarding the intersection of electricity and biology. I also plead guilty of practicing presentism, the tendency to interpret past events in terms of modern concepts, values, and understandings. Presentism is a cardinal sin for historians of science, but I am not a historian, and this is not a history book. I actually find presentism a useful tool to explain how it is that the science got us from where we were then to where we are now, which is one of my main objectives for this book. Which brings us to the logical question. If not a science textbook or a history of science book, what then is this book? I would describe it as a book of explanatory science, written in narrative style that seeks to educate and entertain. I hope you will agree that it fulfills both goals. My intended audience is inquisitive people interested in learning what electricity is and how it works, particularly with regard to how it affects people's lives. I hope that one will learn a lot of new information about electricity. But I also suspect that many people will find that what they thought they knew about electricity is wrong, or at least incomplete. For example, did you know that Benjamin Franklin almost killed himself while performing an electrical experiment with a turkey? I'll bet you thought I was going to say kite. Do you know why people and animals aren't killed by touching electric fences? Did you know that while the measured lengths of lightning bolts keep going up worldwide, with some bolts now hundreds of miles long, the annual lightning death rate in the United States keeps going down? Do you know why people in Denmark are virtually never electrocuted at home? Do you know how amputees with state-of-the-art prosthetic limbs can control the limb's movement just by thinking about it? Did you know that electricity can help totally blind people to see and deaf people to hear? Did you know that shock therapy for mental disorders has nothing to do with electricity? If you don't know the answers to these questions, or even if you do, I think you'll enjoy taking a fresh look at these electricity topics from a somewhat different perspective, a biological one. You will get the most out of this book if you appreciate how it is styled and organized. The book is written as a work of nonfiction, told as an unfolding story of exploration and discovery. It is meant to be listened to as you would listen to a novel, from beginning to end, without skipping chapters or listening to them out of sequence. Each chapter builds on the previous one and sets the stage for the next. Listening to chapters out of order will result in a confusing and garbled storyline. Also, you will find no graphs or tables to distract you, and the mathematics is kept to a minimum. Rather, this book conveys all technical material exclusively within the context of the story. Each chapter in the early part of the book is a self-contained story focused on a particular topic related to electricity or biology, typically neurobiology. The electricity and biology chapters alternate back and forth to support the main thesis of the book, that the sciences of electricity and neurobiology progressed together, hand in hand, so to speak, with advances in one field dependent upon advances in the other. The theme of the early chapters is the premature use of electrical therapies or electrotherapies by physicians, based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the underlying sciences of both electricity and human physiology. Many of these treatments were painful, and virtually none was effective. These early electrotherapy stories are told anecdotally and serve to underscore the level of ignorance about electricity and human physiology that was prevalent in medicine at the time. In the latter part of the book, the stories about electrical physics begin to wane, as I have already presented most of the information needed to understand the fundamental electrical nature of neurobiology. Still, all the stories about neurobiology and electricity have not yet been told. At this point, the neurobiology chapters begin to alternate with medical chapters. The theme of the latter part of the book is how recent insight into the mechanisms underlying electrical and neurological interactions is leading to the development of new electrical treatments for various human maladies. Many of these novel electrical treatments, unlike their predecessors, are currently being scientifically validated as safe and effective. After a hiatus of more than a century, the use of electricity to treat human disease is returning in a big way, and it seems to have a bright future across many medical specialties. The text of the book has ample endnotes. The purpose of the endnotes is twofold: to provide citations and sources for the statements in the narrative, and to supply expanded explanations of something mentioned in the text for individuals who have a particular interest in that topic. The book has no glossary. Just as the best understanding of a word is usually achieved by seeing the word used in context rather than by looking up its definition in a dictionary, such is often the case with technical terminology. All technical words, or common words that are used in a specifically technical way, are italicized at their first appearance in the narrative and defined within the context of the narrative. And there is one last thing you should know before you start listening. Although I believe this book is appropriate for anyone, there are two chapters some might find objectionable. The chapter on early electrotherapies, chapter 4, has some discussion of sexual matters, and the chapter on electrocution, chapter 6, contains a good bit of violence. So, I've written those chapters in such a way that they can be skipped without a significant loss of continuity to the book's narrative. But I hope you don't skip them, as they convey important information regarding health and safety issues, which is one of the reasons I wrote this book in the first place. In any event, you have now been warned. Proceed accordingly. Finally, I assure you I have no connection, financial or otherwise, with any of the companies or products mentioned in this book. Beyond just informative and enjoyable, I'd like the scientific story of this book to be useful. I want it to enable listeners to enhance their everyday interactions with electricity in many practical ways. Electricity is a powerful force of nature that everyone deals with to one extent or another. If we all become a little more knowledgeable about it, our society can use electricity's many powers more wisely, for the betterment and safety of all. I hope you enjoy listening to the story of electricity and come to see sparks in an entirely new light. 1. Sparks will fly. Static electricity. We see spiders, flies, or ants entombed and preserved forever in amber, a more than royal tomb. Sir Francis Bacon. Copenhagen, Denmark is an eye-catching city with bold architecture complementing natural beauty. But if you perform an internet search for images of Copenhagen, most of the hits will show colorful photographs taken from just a single vantage point, the dockside view at Nyhavn Harbor. At Nyhavn, a 17th-century waterfront docking area and now popular entertainment district, many vividly colored buildings and boats line both sides of its narrow waterway. On a sunny day with a blue sky, it is unquestionably the most photogenic location in a city full of photogenic locations. Yet, the most beautiful things in Nyhavn cannot be seen in any of these photographs. Nyhavn's stunning treasures are housed in a small, white building on the extreme far left, out of frame for most pictures of the harbor. The treasures are literally jewels, and they are on display in the House of Amber, a combination jewelry store and amber museum. The three-story building itself is historic, dating to 1606, but its contents are prehistoric, with some amber pieces estimated to be 30 to 50 million years old. As I enter the House of Amber, a young professional woman, smartly dressed, introduces herself as Birgit Niklasson and welcomes me. She works in the House of Amber's Human Resources and Special Projects section, and she offers to give me a tour of the museum's amber collection. Niklasson knows a lot about amber, the national gemstone of Denmark. She explains that amber is fossilized sap from prehistoric pine trees and is found in various parts of the world, but particularly in the Baltic Sea region because of the vast prehistoric conifer forests that existed in this area. Amber, with a density only slightly heavier than water, is remarkably light. As such, it easily was washed into prehistoric rivers where it was carried out to sea. For this reason, amber often can be found on beaches in areas that were once prehistoric river estuaries. In fact, much of the world's amber stockpiles simply were picked up from beaches by professional or amateur collectors. The collectors know which stretches of shoreline are most likely to yield amber, and they visit them after every storm in the hope that the storm will have dislodged more amber from the seafloor and washed new deposits onto the beach. Amber is famous for having inclusions, which are embedded small objects, often insects, frozen in time. The insects were trapped in a sticky tree sap that ultimately solidified and fossilized to become amber. High-quality inclusions increase the amber's ornamental value and frequently end up in some of the finest jewelry. Niklasson shows me the museum's best examples of amber pieces with insect inclusions. She notes that such inclusions are typically not pristine. Rather, the insects are often damaged or have misshapen appendages. Perfect insect inclusions are rare, making them tremendously valuable for jewelry. Jewelry with inclusions of animals larger than the size of insects is extremely rare, and most such pieces are fakes. The fakes are modern-day animals simply embedded in amber-colored synthetic resins. Niklasson tells the story of a woman visitor to the museum who showed off a pendant that appeared to have a perfect inclusion of a small snake. The woman was so proud of her amber pendant that Niklasson didn't have the heart to tell her it was undoubtedly fake. Unfortunately, the woman probably had paid a lot of money for her treasure. But her naivete is understandable. Hawkers of fake amber have deceived even financially shrewd people. Most famously, J.P. Morgan, a wealthy 19th-century American financier and banker, once paid $100,000, $2,900,000 in 2020 dollars, for an amber collection whose most precious piece had an inclusion of a frog. When he donated the collection to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, the curators quickly recognized that the prized amber piece with the frog inclusion was actually a fake. Fortunately, there are several chemical means to identify fake amber from the real stuff. Unfortunately, most of them require a small sample of the amber for analysis and thus are modestly destructive to the piece in question. There is a non-destructive method, though. Nicholson remarks, "The easiest way to identify a fake is simply to rub the suspect amber with a woolen cloth and see if the rubbed amber can move small dust particles. If it is real amber, you can electrify it by rubbing it in this way. That is, the rubbing will cause the amber to take on static electric properties. It will attract small particles, and it may even produce an electrical spark you can feel. In fact, amber's electrical properties make it unique among gemstones and enhance its appeal. All amber is beautiful, and people have likely been adorning themselves with it for as long as there have been people. Archaeologists have found amber pendants dating from 12,000 BC, which was just at the tail end of the last ice age. Yet, the appeal of amber jewelry to primitive peoples went well beyond simply its beautiful appearance. Amber was also known to be magical. People who wore amber jewelry would often feel it give off shocks and could see it attract particles of soil or small seeds after being rubbed with wool. No wonder all sorts of mystical qualities were attributed to amber. Humans have a propensity to immediately apply all new discoveries of natural phenomena toward the treatment of their ailments. We will hear about this recurring pattern time and again throughout the book. Amber was no different. The first recorded medical treatments with amber come from the ancient Greeks, but such practices probably started much earlier. The Greeks sought to utilize the attractive forces of amber to fight disease. They massaged the bodies of sick people, rubbing pain-afflicted areas with amber stones in the hope that amber's attractive forces would pull the pain out of their bodies. Later, the Romans employed amber as both a disease treatment and a disease preventative. Pliny the Elder, the great Roman naturalist and naval commander who was killed at Pompeii by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, recommended wearing amber around the neck to ward off throat diseases and mental disorders. Powdered amber later found its way into various medicines and potions, and many people claimed to have benefited from its healing powers. As late as the 16th century, the famous Swiss physician Paracelsus recommended amber as a noble medicine for the head, stomach, intestines, and other sinews complaints. Whether anything more than a placebo effect was at play is quite doubtful, but even a placebo can have clinical value. Apart from the attractive forces coming from rubbed amber, the stone could also produce sparks. Both the attractive forces and the sparks required the amber to be rubbed, suggesting the two phenomena were somehow related and produced in the same way. But unlike its attractive forces, amber's sparks could be felt and seen, and sometimes the feeling was strong enough to be quite unpleasant. What was the nature of these sparks? And were they good or bad for the body? Was the pain level of the sparks a consequence of the attractive forces? The sparks raised many questions. Before going any further, we should stop here and define exactly what we mean by a spark. People are sometimes sloppy with how they use the term. The modern English word spark is thought to come from the Old English word sparica, meaning a glowing or fiery particle thrown off. The origin of the word is probably extremely old, since the production of heat sparks is one of the most evident consequences of burning wood or smacking two stones together, things that even cave people did regularly. Because sparks can burn skin and eyes, people were careful when dealing with this menacing phenomenon. So it seems likely there would have been a word for such a ubiquitous hazard, even in very primitive lexicons. But the use of the term spark in connection with electrical events came much later, when people started to recognize that the shocks they sometimes felt when they touched objects, like amber, were typically accompanied by very faint flashes of light at the exact point of contact. Since they looked similar to the sparks from fires and stones, and they were also similarly painful to the touch, they were given the same name. But such sparks are, in fact, quite different. The sparks from fires and stones are really just flying fiery particles produced by rapid burning, or intense friction. In contrast, the sparks that produce the shocking sensation from amber are due, as we shall soon hear, to electricity rather than heat. And the sensation they produce isn't a burn, but a direct stimulation of the body's nerves by the electricity. So, the fact that electrical sparks could interact with the body and produce a physical sensation was appreciated at the very moment of their discovery. It is the electrical spark that concerns us here. As time progressed, it gradually became apparent that other substances behaved similarly to amber. If you rubbed them, you could likewise produce attractive forces and sparks. As such, these dual properties that could be produced by rubbing different materials together were called electrical properties, derived from the Latin word electricus, meaning amber-like. The gradual realization that different combinations of paired materials could be rubbed together to produce electrical properties, and the appreciation that there were patterns, orders, and rules as to which material of the rubbed pair would become electrified, was a breakthrough. It opened the door for the systematic study of electrical properties, and moved electricity from the dominion of mysticism into the realm of science. Most people today will confidently tell you that electricity is a current of electrons, and they may even volunteer that an electron has a negative charge. Beyond that, if you challenge them to define what they mean by electron and charge, they probably will start stammering, because these are extremely difficult concepts to grasp, even for physicists. If you press them on what they mean by current, however, their spirits will brighten, because everyone thinks they know what a current is. It is the pattern of flow of a fluid, like water, or a gas, like air. Since electrons flow in currents, exploring electricity as you might investigate currents of water could result in some very important and highly comprehensible insight. This is exactly what the first scientific investigators of electricity did. And they did so with no knowledge of electrons. They just imagined electric currents to be equivalent to water currents, and they simply thought electricity to be a current of some invisible fluid. For the most part, this approach worked, and people learned much by thinking of electricity as a current of an invisible fluid. Of course, electricity isn't really an invisible fluid, so if you take this model too literally and start trying to find the invisible fluid, you will be doomed to failure. Michael Faraday, the brilliant 19th-century scientist who would transform our understanding of electricity, knew this well. In 1821, he admonished his colleagues, "Those who consider electricity as a fluid, or as two fluids, conceive that a current or currents of electricity are passing through the wire during the whole time that it remains connected to a battery. There are many arguments in favor of the materiality of electricity, and but few against it. But still, it is only a supposition, and it will be well to remember that we have no proof of the materiality of electricity or of the existence of any fluid flow through the wire." Notwithstanding Faraday's admonition, electrical fluid is a good place to start if we want to understand electrical principles, because there are many parallels between electric currents and water currents. So, that's what we'll do here. We'll begin our exploration of electricity by focusing on its behavior as a current, and we'll worry about the exact physical nature of the imaginary fluid that comprises electrical current later. Of course, almost everyone knows the famous 18th-century American printer, inventor, colonial statesman, and scientist Benjamin Franklin is very important to the history of electricity, and that he once flew a kite in a lightning storm to demonstrate such storms were electrical. But his accomplishments as an electricity scientist wouldn't have been diminished even if he had never flown his kite. The kite stunt turned out to be a double-edged sword for Franklin's image. Rather than being a scientific discovery, it was really just a demonstration of electrical principles he already understood better than anyone else. Franklin proved his electrical knowledge by dramatically tempting fate with a kite, and he received outsized attention for it. The kite makes an
Sample complete. Ready to continue?